You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this edition of The View. Our usual host, Meg Riley, is not feeling well. And so I am sitting in. I'm Tom Shade, retired minister in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we have a great program here today. We have a special guest today, and that is the Reverend Cheryl M. Walker, who is the lead minister, senior pastor at the...
Only pastor.
The only...
only.
The solo pastor at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Wilmington, North Carolina. It used to be the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, but they're in the process of changing their name. Welcome, Cheryl.
Well, thank you, Tom. Here in balmy North Carolina, we are in the middle of primary season. Our primary is next week. But we have early voting down here, and one of the things in New Hanover County, where I am, we had a Souls to the Polls Day this past Sunday, and we encouraged everyone to vote together after church. So, you know, get in your church van or get in your cars and caravan down to the polling place and vote on Sunday. And it looked to be pretty successful. So we're hoping that Sunday voting is something that we get to keep, because for a lot of people, it's the one day of the week they can vote. They can make it to the polls. They don't have to worry about missing work. They don't necessarily have to. They could bring their kids with them, or there's somebody usually at home. So it's a big deal for us to get Sunday voting. And it was also the 50th anniversary of the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. So we definitely got a lot of people out, and we're hoping that there's a good turnout here in at least eastern North Carolina. I don't know about the rest of the state, but...
It's all uphill from there, right?
It's all uphill from here. If you can get Wilmington... Wilmington is interesting because it really is kind of a very purplish area. If you can get Wilmington, it is a good indicator of how the entire state will go.
Now, did your congregation participate in the Souls to the Polls?
Yes, we did. Okay. Yes, we did. We were even in the newspaper with our little yellow T-shirts on, a couple of us, Elizabeth and I, and me. we were in our local newspaper, and those yellow T-shirts are just everywhere.
There we are. I was in, when I was in... St. Louis, for right around the time of the non-indictment of Darren Wilson, I went to a meeting of that was being organized among churches, and they were kind of talking about what's happening. These are people not connected with Unitarian Universalism, just other clergy, and one of the clergy said, "Well, I hear that all those yellow people are going to show up." Right? And I'm thinking, what? Yellow people? And then
where do yellow people?
It finally hit me. That, oh, geez, they're talking about us. Right? And I go, oh, okay, there you go. Well, Cheryl M. Walker also, in addition to being the solo lead, senior, junior, and everything pastor, all-around pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Wilmington, North Carolina, is also the President-elect of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association, and at General Assembly, this—that means she's this year she's the vice president, and then.
No. Actually, I'm just president designate.
There's a president designate. Right.
Jennifer Rue is the vice president.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Yeah. I'm actually in the UUM.
I was going to say you're on second. Yeah.
But I don't pay attention to that stuff a lot. But she is the president designate of UUMA, and she will begin her, two-year term of office in, three-year term of office in, at Ministry Days in June. So Are you looking forward to that, or does now that you've seen it for a couple of years?
For a few months now, yes, I am, and it is also daunting. I see all the work that Linda does, and I'm
Linda Olson-Peebles,
who is our current president, and you know she is part of a ministry team.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the challenge for me is the time that it will take away from my congregation. But my congregation has been very supportive, and so I'm not foreseeing that to be a problem. But it is a lot of time, as well as on top of being a solo pastor in a congregation of over 200.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of work. So that part is daunting, but it's a great board, and we're doing great work. We'll be, this year we are working on, and we'll probably continue next year, we looking at our vision for the UUMA. We spent a year last year we spent time talking to all the different chapters, getting feedback from our constituency about where do they think the UUMA needs to go and what our vision is for the future. And this year we're going to shape that and look at our current vision statements and say, what's missing? Is it still relevant? Is it still what we ought to be doing? So I'm excited about that. And I think the UUMA is just doing exciting work altogether. So to continue to be part of that is great, you know, and to help shape some of that is better.
Well, I have about a million questions as a seminarian, so I'll try to pace myself. The one that we didn't talk about this before, but I'm curious about, how do you, so we've seen a couple of years now of more folks retiring from the profession than joining, more folks walking off the stage than on the stage. And how do you see that playing out going forward for our congregations and for folks who are coming into the job of minister? And and what's the role? Do you think, is there a role, if there is, of the UUMA in this?
I think the UUMA has two roles in there. One with our retired membership is to keep them connected with the UUMA. Just because you've retired from full-time ministry does not necessarily mean, you know, it doesn't mean you're no longer a member of the UUMA. In fact, you are still a member of the UUMA. And then keeping people involved in the UUMA and using their wisdom. For people on the other end of the spectrum who are just entering, is really getting them involved in the UUMA as well. One of the things that part of our mission is collegiality. I can't, you know, having been in ministry for quite a few years now, over a decade, I can't say enough about the importance of collegiality. You can't make it by yourself. If you think you can, you will be in trouble. You'll first get in trouble with your congregation, and God knows what other trouble you might get yourself into. But when you are with colleagues, your colleagues will do two things. They will support you in the difficult times, and they will be your holy friends and name the sins you have fallen in love with. Mm-hmm. So,
do you think we actually do that enough? I mean, speaking as a guy who's not yet a minister.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I think that there are... It's interesting because while we think it's one of the most important things, we don't often get that feedback as it being one of the most important things that we do. You know, we see continuing education becomes number one for people. But collegiality, I think that's the number one thing that should be on everybody's list and unfortunately isn't on everyone's list. And as
I totally,
Go ahead, Tom.
I totally agree, and I'm on the continuing education, you know, committee, and the collegiality, I think, is more important, and has been, it hasn't been real conscious. We've been in this chapter structure, which doesn't really work anymore because of so many. For two reasons. One is the number of community ministers, and our mm-hmm. chapters often meet during the week when community ministers are at their jobs. Also, the number of younger ministers with children, sometimes the way chapter life works isn't real conducive for people given children and childcare responsibilities for, you know, overnight retreats and stuff like that. So it's there's the chapter thing doesn't quite work anymore in the way it used to. And what's happened is then the collegiality kind of dwindles down to the people who are involved in the chapters, which are really only about 30% of the ministers. So mm-hmm. more conscious strategy has to go on to build that collegiality. I mean, I think the first question, which is the most important thing, I mean, I think the first question the MFC should be asking people like Bob is, have you built, describe your collegial network. If you haven't built a collegial network while you're in seminary, you're not going to have one when you're a minister. And if you don't have one, that's the biggest predictor of future failure. So really the first question is it's not as hard for people like Bob who's at Meadville Lombard, right? Where you have a seminarian network already in place. For people like myself who went to Perkins, you have to build a network. You have to, have to step out into it. It's there. But
On the subject of collegiality, as someone who came into ministry and Facebook was already there, and so I've only known that reality. What difference do you feel that has made? Because I have wonderful local colleagues, but on a day-to-day, basis, I'm touching in with colleagues across the country, or if you look at over at England, across the world, and we're sharing. I'm in so many different groups. Like I'm in a pastor parents group, so we're sharing things about that. Or in one of the larger colleague groups, where you can just toss out the question, any question, whether it's, hey, yeah. anyone know yeah. a good story on this topic, to, hey, this is happening in my church, And I'm also I'm really passionate about this because that's how I prepared for the MFC. I took 6 months where I, said to all of my potential colleagues, give me questions, and I'm going to answer them this week. And then they, would argue with me, which, frankly, by the time I got to the MFC, the MFC was way easier than my colleagues.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, I do think things like Facebook have helped in that. But I also think it has its limitations. First of all, there are just some things you should never put on Facebook. There is the electronic world, and whatever you put out there, I don't care what they say, their privacy issues, their privacy is, you have now put it out there for the entire world. So you should always assume that whatever you put electronically somewhere, the entire world will be able to see it at some point. Those emails on your private server, yeah, right. So it has its place. I mean, it does foster a certain level of collegiality, but it doesn't substitute for collegiality of smaller groups of people you know. So, Facebook calls everybody a friend, but not everybody is your friend there.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you should know what month I was, if you're really a friend, you know what month I was born in. Maybe not the day. but that's kind of my bottom line. So it's not really that same level. I think it's a good place. I mean, I do see the UUMA colleagues page, and it's one of my top feeds, and it is interesting to see that you do get a lot of information and a lot of help, and this is one way that people can connect. But I think that's a step. It's not the end all and be all. This is not the place where your holy friends will tell you about the sins you are so in love with. And I love that term. We were at the Beyond the Call, the entrepreneurial ministry, and that was a term that one of our presenters gave to us, holy friends, those people who will support you but also tell you about your sins and that you have fallen in love with. And I don't see that's going to happen in those large groups.
Well, that, sure. Go ahead, Bob. Go ahead.
Well, I just got a question sent to me from a seminarian on Facebook asking about the UUMA and the role of fostering in care development for seminarians who are looking. I mean, Tom, you talked about the remoteness for seminarians who are not at a UU identity seminary. So,
yes.
What about developing collegial relationships with the ordained ministers, in the local cluster? They're starving for this.
That is something that we are actively working on, especially given the fact that the RSCCs went away. So, what replaces that? And so we are part of a joint effort to create in-care networks. There are some already in existence. There's, I know, in the Denver area out of ILIF, in New York out of Union, and the Union Drew and NYTS. So that is something that we have to look at across the board. How does every seminarian that we know of, by the way, we don't know of you until you actually fill out paperwork, how do we connect all of those new people in our midst into the UUMA? How do we build their collegiality? How do we build collegiality with the ministers in their areas? And so that is a big question for us.
One of the things that's of interest and is a continuing project that I don't know much about, so maybe you can help me with this, Cheryl, is there's been work on developing collegial relationships with the other professional groups of religious professionals, Lareda, the Musicians Network, etc. I know there's like a council or there's some organized channel back and forth. You know about that, and can you tell us about how that's developing?
Well, I'm not the expert on that, but we have had some intentional conversations with the heads with representatives from Lareda, the UUMN, not the administrators yet, but I think that's a group that has to be eventually included as well as the membership coordinators. And I think that's ongoing. That's always going to be an ongoing dialogue between the UUMA and the UUMN and Lareda, as well as any other professional organizations. I think the last time they got together, there were some recommendations that came out. I'm not sure where we are in implementing all of those. Aisha, you may know even more about that.
So there's an actual document that came out of a shared ministry task force, and there were representatives from Lareda, UUMA, UUMN. It was the three, I would say comfortably the largest groups. And it's online. I'm not at a computer, I'm on a phone, but at some point I'll send the link for CLF folks who watch The View, because it's actually a really important document that takes a big picture view on, ministers, religious educators, musicians, and our relationship and how it works in congregations. And what's interesting, even the word colleague, There are ministers that under no circumstances will they call anyone who's not ordained a colleague. And then I've worked with some ministers that call me colleague from day one, or, you know, so that's an interesting thing in itself, because we're in the same line of work in that we are working together in a ministry to serve a congregation. And yes, we have different paths, but when, you know, when we're in a congregation and, you know, many times this was the first, although now I'm the only person, we don't even have a minister. When I started, there were two ministers. But I've been in congregations where it was just me and the minister, where we didn't even have a musician. We had to work together. And it was actually, I'm very grateful and lucky to say, those first smaller congregations, I worked with phenomenal ministers who had no problem with language and empowerment and being mentors. But when it doesn't work, it's painful. And actually, Linda Olson Peebles came to Lareda two years ago and said publicly, she said, "I want to apologize for any hurt caused by a minister to any, you know, to any of you, if anyone has ever been hurt." And that was so, I think some people even teared up, because we had never heard that before. There was almost a non-acknowledgement that ministers in positions of power cause pain to their people who report to them. And so the shared ministry report was really a powerful step forward in acknowledging that we have to work together. We just do. I mean, if we're going to serve Unitarian Universalism, let's work together, because we're all on the same page. We all want to go to the same place. So I think that's a good thing. And when I've seen relationships work well, the congregation does better.
Yeah,
Aisha, and I would almost look at, you know, you're not coming to Finding Our Way Home this year, but for those of you who don't know, every year there is a retreat for religious professionals of color. It started out as just the ministers, and then expanded to the religious educators, and then expanded to the musicians, and then expanded to the administrators, and then every group of religious professionals are invited. And when we're in the room together, you don't know who's who. And there is really a building of respect amongst the different people in that room at that time, and we get to know each other as individuals. I think that then translates when we are back in our congregational setting, or we hope it translates. And I think that's a model that we can start looking at. You know, oftentimes people on the margins are people on the margins, and nobody thinks, hey, you know what, maybe we should be doing what they're doing. Because, you know, well, we're so whatever. whereas people on the margins often have something very important to tell to people who are in the dominant culture. I think, and this, we're going to segue into the Karn book right here. isn't that nice how I did that for you, Tom?
Yeah, I know. I was like, how am I going to change the subject over here to the Karn book? And then I also want to talk about your great essay in the UU World, but we'll get to that.
All right. So Karn is the Committee on Anti-Racism, Anti-Oppression, Multiculturalism, is putting out a book, and it is talking about the experiences of people of color who are serving in our predominantly white congregations. A lot of work has been done beyond categorical thinking, a lot of conversations about how majority white congregations can learn to have people of color in professional roles in their congregations. And so a lot of work has been done about that over the years. But no one asked, so how's it working for the people of color? No one asked. I think Mitra was the one who came up with this idea and said, well, how's it working for us? And what we experience inform other people? When I look at what people are talking about, I'm like, you know, this will a lot of other people will also look at that and say, oh, I'm experiencing this too, but maybe for different reasons. And so how are you coping with, how are you adapting in these situations? Because maybe I can learn how to adapt in them better as well. So I'm excited about the book. It will be on your shelves probably next year at this time, or if not sooner. Inshallah. People on the margins often have something to tell people in the dominant culture, but often people in the dominant culture don't think that.
Right, and I'm in the book. I'm the only non-ordained person. Thank you for your generosity, UUMA, for allowing me to be in it. Natalie Fenimore and I also wanted to lift up that it was Mitra Ranama who is the Mitra you're talking about, because we have several Mitras in the UUMA.
This is true. We have one more. That's Mitra 1, Mitra 2. Or sometimes Mitra 2 is Mitra 1.
Mitra Ranama, yeah. And the other thing I want to lift up is that the authors were convened in Chicago in September, and why that's important is our conversation was recorded, and so some of that conversation will also be in the book, and I'm hoping the juicy bits get in. I don't know if they will, but it was a really compelling it was interesting because Mary Bernard sent me each of us has to sign off on what, you know, because maybe we said things we want to take back. And so Mary sent me mine and she said, you know, please be mindful. This will be printed. And I said, you know, Mary, my tolerance for what I say is kind of probably too high. So you judge what probably shouldn't get in there because I'm actually okay with everything that came out of my mouth. So I don't know. I'm positive, you know, 90% of it's not going to get in there. Any, you know, I said, what I think is controversial, probably, you know, I think very little of what I say is controversial, but I understand that it can be. So anyway.
I had some conversations with Mitra and some of the other folks at different, we had some center CARM discussions, and what really struck me was the notion that what ministers of color experience extreme versions in some cases of what all ministers and all religious professionals are experiencing in their churches. You know, who are you to tell us anything question, you know, the authority question, the question of boundaries around your personal life, the questions around boundaries about what you're supposed to do, you know, as an assistant minister who was acquainted with both ends of the plunger in the church, you know, that role of the minister as a all-purpose handyman or cleaning lady for the church. All those things are endemic, but they present more extremely, it is felt, among ministers of color. And so that's what I think learning how people adapt to that can help all of us. You know, that whole question of who's in charge here and what does it being in charge mean? It seems to me that this is brought out. Plus, I mean, I thought, you know, the very beginning question that was raised with this, what I heard was like that we've spent a lot of time imagining ourselves as white ministers preaching to a congregation of color, when that's not what's happening. That's like the exact opposite of, that's like a fantasy world that we prefer to think about, when actually what's happening is ministers of color are preaching to ministering to our largely white congregations. And just that was like, when I first heard that, that just snapped my head back as like, oh, right? Oh, that dash of reality, the whiff of ammonia that reality is.
Oh, absolutely. And so, and what does that mean? You know, what can we say that our white colleagues can't say, and what can we not say that our white colleagues can say? Or say sooner. And we think, oh, well, you just say straight on the pulpit. Yeah, Yeah, but freedom comes with costs. Freedom ain't free.
God forbid that anybody would think that their brave minister, who's supposed to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted, would actually have, quote, an agenda.
An agenda, right.
Which is code word for a point of view and a mission. I just want to reintroduce ourselves to our listeners. This is The View. I'm Tom Shade, sitting in for Meg Riley, who is sick today. Our special guest today is Reverend Cheryl M. Walker, who is the president-designate of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association, which is the professional organization of UU ministers. And our panelists are, of course, why don't you introduce yourselves one more time, where you are, and what you do, or what your current manifestation of ministry is.
I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford. I am in Austin, Texas, and my current manifestation of ministry is that I'm the solo pastor for Live Oak Unitarian Universalist Church.
I'm Aisha Hauser, and I am. While I serve as the director of religious education for a large congregation, we have not had any minister since the end of August. So I've, been the only full-time religious professional. We have a large staff, but they are operations. I have an assistant, but we have had no minister. So that's been an interesting journey. I'm not sure what the manifestation is.
So I think you're manifesting it. I think you're manifesting ministry right now, Aisha.
Tom's expression.
And someday the MFC is going to look at that as on the job equivalence. But go ahead, Bob.
Oh, I was just going to say, Tom's expression, knowing both ends of the plunger, probably really applies to you now, Aisha. I'm Bob LaValle, and I'm a third-year seminarian at Meadville Lombard and an intern minister at the Church of the Larger Fellowship.
Great. Cheryl, Cheryl seems to have blanked out for a minute. I don't know, maybe that's...
Yeah, we lost...
Oh, there she is. Okay.
I have another seminarian question that kind of relates to what we're talking about, too. So in seminary, it's almost fetish to talk about ministerial authority and establishing our ministerial authority. And I mean, even the language itself seems a little weird to me. I'm much more concerned with developing my ministerial presence. But is there a tension between our cultivation of ministerial authority and what might be a more effective model of distributive leadership, given how our congregations really work, where lay leaders really make it happen, and the DRE is the backbone of the church, and so on. Discuss.
I think that's very interesting that you would not think about authority. As a white male, you never have to think about authority. You walk in the door, and your authority is assumed. No one's going to ask you, well, why do you get to decide what happens on Sunday morning? Or
that happens
most people. Most people, and when you say, because I'm the minister, I have the authority because I'm the minister. So as we have in this society overall an idea of authority being held by heterosexual white males. The further you are from that, the less authority you will be granted. So that it is a process of earning authority, and a less personal authority you will be given. So for those of us really far away, hello.
Are you doing interpretive dance? Really far away.
as a black woman who's a lesbian, well, okay, so that may be the opposite. When I walked in the door, I had no personal authority. So the only authority I actually had was the authority of the office of minister. I could say I have this authority because it is in our tradition that the minister has this authority. And so actually I had to hold on to that tradition of authority probably longer than, say, you might have to, Bob, or you might have had to, Tom, because it took a longer time to get personal authority that says, oh, she's in charge of this because she's in charge of this. It is great to think that we have shared, I think one of the problems we have when we think about shared power and shared authority is we think it is shared for everything all of the time. And that's not what shared authority and shared power is. Shared power is no one has all the power all of the time. But people do have power and authority some of the time over things for which they should have power and authority. So when we think about these models of, well, let's not, you know, let's share. Well, no, we don't share. We don't share everything all of the time. So you do have to say, because I'm the minister, sometimes. And there are decisions you get to make. And by the way, you will be held accountable for almost every decision everybody makes, even if you did not have the authority and the power to make that decision. The buck will stop at your desk. And everybody wants to think, well, we're sharing that until it all falls apart, in which case, oh, by the way, it's you. You. No, not us. You. So there is a certain level of authority and a certain level of power, and if we look at authority as the ability to say yes and power as the ability to say no, and no trumps yes, then there are things about which you have authority, there are things for which you have power, and there are things you have nothing but, you know, influence, and understanding what your roles are in those different things.
Thank you for, that was great, Cheryl, and thank you for raising up that this conversation can't be had without talking about the social location of the asker. And as a white, straight-presenting guy, you know, I'm asking from a very different position than other folks. Appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, because we ministers have the tradition gives ministers a fair amount of authority, but our current interpretation of the tradition, widely shared, is one that gives very little positional authority to the minister. Ministers are supposed to earn all their authority personally. And of course, it's easier to earn all that personal authority if you are, you know, the further you are up the hierarchical chain of social positioning. So it's easy for me to earn personal authority because people are predisposed to give it to me. So, you know, to me, the big question is how do we reinterpret the tradition back to a point where people say, you know, this person went to 4 years of seminary, was inspected within an inch of their lives by the Ministerial Fellowship Committee, had a psychological evaluation, did a CPE, and did an internship. And maybe that experience means that they know something about Unitarian Universalism more than the person who walked in the door last week and signed the membership book. Maybe...
But Tom, how many people even know that? I mean, this is a message that I keep repeating a lot because, you know, I run into people who are like, oh, so how do you become a UU minister? Maybe I can be one, you know, next week.
Yeah, that's kind of like Universal Life Church, you know. I run away on the internet. I got this. No, I mean, we are as a body about as inspected as almost any other profession. I mean, good Lord, they check us out and at a very impersonal and intrusive way. You know, we are accountable for, you know, we are asked to discuss in, you know, in these bodies how we handle our attractions, you know, to other people. And do we have
our money.
And our money. And do we have appropriate boundaries, you know? And you would think it would give us something in these.
But Tom, I think one of the reasons, and if you go back to the Commissioner on Appraisal, who's in charge here,
mm-hmm.
One of the things they pointed out was positional authority got lost when the number of women in ministry increased.
Mm.
And I don't think that's a coincidence. It's not that we all of a sudden became a different society and we didn't really want to do the positional authority thing. I think it really, we don't want to give these people authority.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to give women authority. We're not really there. We say we're there, but we're not really there. Because we also have to remember that there are two different groups. So there is the MFC. And they've done all of their work on anti-oppression, on getting rid of gender bias, all of that. And then we have congregations. And really, when did we require them to do some of this work? You know, one of the things the MFC asks you about is, so tell me about all that work that you did in getting rid of all of your biases. We don't have a test when you walk in the door. Could you please fill out this questionnaire? Because we need to give you some remedial work on this. So we still had a case where we had congregations who were still, you know, going, I'm not sure I want, why are women in charge? And it's like, well, we can question, we will question authority now in ways that we didn't because there are people in charge who we don't think naturally should be in charge. It's great that, and no offense, Asia, don't take this the wrong way, but, like, they should be the DRE or maybe the assistant minister, but not the senior minister, not the senior minister of a large church, God forbid. So, you know, because those are positions of real authority, and that says a lot about how we thought about all of those other positions as well. So when we don't ask the question about how much of that is tied to gender, then I think we're allowing a cultural bias to continue. And I think that that bias still exists in Unitarian Universalism today.
Do you feel like there's any generational differences between this in terms of the congregant, you know, the younger congregants who are coming in?
There are younger congregants coming?
Oh, okay.
Let's go ask them. This is bitter self-reflective. We aren't really this discouraged.
I should throw out my experience. I am incredibly lucky to be at a church that has many of not only congregants but many of the leaders are 20s, 30s, early 40s, and I feel like there has been a lifting up of my authority. Now, granted, you can kind of pat me on the head. I've only been here a year and a half. But it was really refreshing to walk in and have people who were being really open about, you're the minister, and you know, we want to honor this.
Yeah, I actually do think it's generational. And yes, I mean, because I have younger people coming in my congregation as well. But the culture overall has not shifted yet. And it may take an entire, you know, generation for us to shift that cultural bias against women before we let it go. But it's still there overall.
But I wonder if that, Cheryl, is, because I'm thinking to when we're together, you know, and finding our way home and we're in, I wonder if this is a replication of the white dominant paradigm, because in cultures where matriarchs are revered and seen as, matriarchal cultures, and here in the Northwest, many of the Native American cultures revere matriarchy, and they're not quite as patriarchal. And I see the patriarchy that's replicated in Unitarian Universalism as part of the white dominant paradigm that we could say we're a liberal faith. I don't think we're progressive in any. I don't think there's in how we operate. I don't think we're very progressive. So, I think there's that element also of the you know, seeing white men as immediately having a certain, and I'm sorry, but so I don't want to be offensive, but the white men who are ministers, I don't see many of them understand how to step back at all. Like, just, you know, they take it and run, and, you know, present company excluded, but I've seen it in a way that's just, disappointing. It's just disappointing. I'm like, wow, you know, what just came out of your mouth was a very white male thing to say without any clue that was culturally insensitive, or that you're saying that with a lot of power. So I also think there's a sense of personal responsibility among white male ministers to understand the shift for them, which is scary. I mean, we're not immune from what's going on in the wider world. Like, why are all these angry white men running around? Because they're losing, you know, they're feeling the world is changing, and they're losing their position of absolute power that's been there for millennia. So,
well, the experience of being the experience of being a person with where you have to prove your personal authority in the environment puts everybody in this competitive situation unconsciously try to push yourself forward. So what's needed now among ministers is, you know, the ability to step back and let other leadership come to the fore. But what it feels like a lot of time is that your authority's still not there at all. And so you're kind of like, I have to, you know, you have to prove yourself that you're worthy every day. And so it becomes competitive, and it becomes, you know, hard to go, wait a second, if this is what I'm experiencing, how much more difficult is this environment where you have to prove yourself every day for people who aren't playing the game on the easy level as I am. So it gets this whole environment it brings out the worst in people in a certain way. This whole kind of competitive, you have to prove yourself every day, you know, kind of situation.
Tom, go ahead. And I'm going to, you know, I mean, that reminds me of in Fred's book, The Error of Our the Trinity of Errors. You know, one
You're really
of
really good at these segues. Can I say that?
I should be a host.
Right, we're going to work you in here. You know, this.
Yeah, really, because I have so much time. Really,
I know.
Noted.
You know, and that allergy to authority, as well as our exceptionalism and our individualism. I mean, we so mirror American society just perfectly. I know we want to think that we're above that, but we are a perfect mirror of American society, and at least those of us in America, for our Canadian siblings, I think that they may mirror Canada. Mm-hmm. You know, but we here in America, we are mirroring American society exactly. And, you know, one of the I don't
And I see those things as so tied together, the authority, the individualism, and the exceptionalism, that it's hard to say which one is worse. I personally think the individualism leads to both of those. I am, it's all about me. I'm so special. Who are you?
That's often how people come into our churches, is that they have a unmet need to assert themselves, who they are, what, you know, either against, you know, kind of their personal background or, you know, or the social background that they come from, that they have a need to assert themselves, and yet they come into our church and they go, wow, this is like the promised land. I can, you know, I can be myself. I can believe whatever I want. Nobody can tell me what to do. Nobody's the boss around here. We get to decide everything ourselves, you know. And then somehow there has to be, you know, and you see with the people who really become Unitarian Universalists with the over the time, there's some kind of transformation that goes on that moves them from that individualism to a sense of, you know, some commitment to the community that they're in. Maybe it's no wider than their local congregation. But there's also, you know, this kind of symbolic, you know, they want to wear the chalice, they want to wear the, you know, they want that identity. But somehow, what is that transformation that goes on that moves people away from that individualism? Because whatever it is, we got to figure out how to do it better. Right?
I think one of the if we look at the religious right, they are strong and they are strict. So this is what it means to be a member of our congregate, our church, and they are strong and they are strict. And we are lax and we are weak. So we have... these principles, and I don't really want to make them into our creed, but they are, they speak very much to our values. And yet, how strict are we in saying that we will call each other out when we are not living by them? They're just like nice to have statements on a piece of paper. Mm. We are not particularly in saying, when we are Unitarian Universalists, we do believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Let's just start with that one. And that means every person. That means people on the other end of political spectrum. So that while we may argue ideas, when we argue against people, we are not being Unitarian Universalists. But you get us in a room of people who are on one side of that political spectrum, and we will talk about those people on the other side of the political spectrum, showing none of the inherent, you know, we show them no dignity or worth. And at a certain point, if this is to be a community that really stands for something, we also have to start standing in those moments and say, no, that is not what we do. Now, if we want to argue their ideas, we can argue their ideas till the cows come home. But somehow, being a Unitarian Universalist has to mean more than signing a book and making a pledge.
Amen.
Can I say, can I jump in? I want to, Cheryl, because some of the individualism, and I said this last week when we just talked about covenant, and I experience Unitarian Universalism as a faith differently when I'm in different communities. It feels differently when I'm in finding our way home. I feel the best of what Unitarian Universalism can be. When I'm in certain other groups that are predominantly white and the rampant individualism is prevalent, it feels painful. And so I wonder how much you think that the individualism, I mean, I don't experience people of color when they come into UU congregations. I don't have the same experience of their wants and needs than I do of white people. I feel like we start with we, but that's just I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
You're going to have to hear her thoughts in the next exciting edition of The View when we have Cheryl M. Walker back, because it's so clear we have a lot to talk about with her. But we have run out of time. Next week, no, I know, this is awful. But next week we're going to have our Black Lives of UU monthly show, and details will be, well, you have to tune in to find out what that's going to be like. But until then, thank you, and thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you for inviting me. It was wonderful to be with you this morning.
All right. So long.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.